Welcome to the weekly podcast from the Church of England. This week we look back at York's Synod and hear more about the Reform and Renewal programme, also an update on a campaign by the Christian Minority Ethnic Anglican Concerns. But first, the lead bishop on healthcare, James Newcombe, is urging churchgoers to write to their MPs if they're opposed to assisted suicide. It comes ahead of the second reading of the bill, which is expected to happen in September. The bill would make it lawful for medical professionals to provide assistance with suicide for qualifying terminally ill people who request it. I asked Bishop James, who's the Bishop of Carlisle, to explain why the Church of England opposes a change in the law.
We feel that the current law strikes a good balance between, on the one hand, making it clear that life is valuable, all life is valuable, and we wish to preserve that, and that's a crucial part of the fabric of our society. But on the other hand, being moderately lenient where there are situations, desperate situations, where people assist others to end their own lives. Now, this is a very difficult balance to strike. We think the present legislation has got it about right, and any change would be detrimental.
Why do you want people to get in touch with their MPs?
There is a private member's bill coming to the House of Commons which would legalise assisted suicide. And we believe that this would cause a fundamental shift in our attitude towards suicide in society. It would create a climate in which things which at the moment we regard as completely unacceptable gradually to start becoming acceptable. And we're very, very concerned about the most vulnerable people in our society, including those who are elderly and those who feel under pressure from their families or from friends to bring their lives to an end because they feel they're being a burden.
What would you say to the people, though, who say to you, you surely don't want to see people suffering in their final months, weeks and days?
Of course we don't. And I think what I would want to say there is that the argument about compassion, which has been used a great deal in the debate so far, is true on both sides. We fully acknowledge that those who are bringing this bill and who argue in favour of assisted suicide are doing so out of the most compassionate of motives, usually. But equally, we're wanting to stress that the other side of the argument is also about compassion. It's compassion for those who are most vulnerable. And for those who are in great difficulties and perhaps suffering towards the end of their life, what we want to do is to encourage better and better palliative care. Already huge advances have been made in that direction. It's quite unusual nowadays for people to be in great pain towards the end of their life. And experience from those countries where assisted suicide already happens shows that a fear of pain is not one of the main reasons why people request it.
What do you think needs to be done then, as well as the palliative care? What other areas would you like to see looked at?
I think our overall care for people towards the end of their life, and a greater awareness of, first of all, the length of time that it sometimes takes now for people to die with medical advances as they are, and a need for communities as a whole, not only to have that awareness, but for people to be caring for one another. Now that we've, to some extent, lost the sense of extended family, which perhaps was greater in previous generations, it's quite important that people should be cared for, because the end of life, as we all know, can be quite a frightening time for some. And I think the whole emotional and psychological side is as important as the physical side.
As we've discussed, you're asking parishioners and churchgoers to get in contact with their MP. Do you think that can make a difference?
Well, I think it will, yes. Those who are in favour of assisted suicide are already, as I understand it, conducting an email campaign. And I think MPs' mailboxes will be flooded with emails suggesting that they should vote in favour of the legislation, were quite keen to show that that actually is not everybody's viewpoint by any means. And I would love it if churchgoers were able to get in touch with their MP, either by going to see them or by writing them a letter, expressing some of the concerns that perhaps they feel and that all of us feel in the Church of England.
James Newcombe, the Bishop of Carlisle. The last synod of the current term finished in York on Monday. Debates this time included climate change, education, and a presentation on the representation of minority ethnic Anglicans in the church, more of which later. There were two fringe meetings updating progress on the reform and renewal process. I caught up with the Bishop of Truro, Tim Thornton, who was at both events. He's spoken before of how he thinks the Church of England needs radical change to halt the steady decline in congregations. I started by asking him if reform and renewal is the answer.
There's no one simple answer. I think it's about changing the culture and getting dioceses and clergy and lay people all across the nation understanding what the urgency is of the situation and then what part they can play in doing something about it.
So do you think it's not just one section of the church's role to play here?
Everybody has a part to play. It's about discipleship. That's why that's so important to me. That's why it's number one in our strategy in the Diocese of Truro. I think it should be and is in reform and renewal. I think it's about, what do I do as a disciple of Jesus Christ?
When you talked about decline in the past, what were you thinking then needed to be done to try to arrest it?
I think number one is to try and understand why the church is declining. So I think we have to not be afraid of research and looking back and asking some questions about what's happened. That can be very uncomfortable, but then I think we need to actually come up with some new ideas. And one of the problems, as I've often said, is that I have a problem with this myself. Imagination is in very great demand and it's not around very much. So how do we actually think about new ways of doing things? So often the idea we come up with is actually a rehash of something that didn't work before anyway.
Why will that change now, though?
Because I think, well, that's partly why I felt it was important for me to put my head above the parapet and say we need to make some radical changes. Because I think from a leadership point of view, if you don't give people permission and help them to explain, understand there is a real urgent need to do something, then you begin to get some real traction on what changes might look like.
Now, one of the things that you've talked about in both the group sessions is incumbent leading parishes. Yeah. What is that? What is it that you're thinking about that?
Well, all I'm saying is that if you look back over the past, many things have led to our decline. Of course they have. One of the constants is that there have been vicars leading parishes. That's the model in the vast majority of Anglican Church of England parishes up and down this country. I think it's just worth at least asking the question, is there something within that model that has actually added to the decline rather than added to the growth? And I think part of the problem is there is a real dependency of far too many people in our pews assuming the vicar will do all the work, sadly, and there's also a problem with the vicar assuming they're going to do all the work. So I think we break that open, and hey presto, if people go to church to help the vicar, that's not very helpful. If people go to church because they're disciples of Jesus Christ, whether they're ordained or not, then we begin to get somewhere.
Is there any issue here with vicars having too many parishes and churches to look after?
Well, of course there is. It's not a very good model of working if you just add them on more and more, especially if the model is still the vicar will do what the vicar's always done. So again, it's got to be deconstructed. That's why in Truro we're looking at teams running churches in which there may be one or more person ordained, and over a wider area there will be an ordained person probably, but they will have a very different sort of ministry. Now it's up to people like me to help the clergy understand what that different sort of ministry might be. It's no good me just shouting them and saying do it differently. We have to work together to find out what that might be.
You've been in both the sessions here at Synod. Yeah. What's your feeling been for the questions you've had and whether there's an appetite for change?
Yes, I'm absolutely encouraged. I am really. A huge appetite for change. I think nobody has been sort of asking questions saying, why are we doing this? We must stop it. Of course, there is lots of concern and anxiety. We're talking about major changes. And when people don't know what the changes are, they're absolutely right to be anxious and concerned. But I've been very encouraged by the level of engagement, by the good questions, by the appropriate way in which people have been trying to help each other, not trip each other up.
The Bishop of Truro, Tim Thornton. Also at Synod, the Bishop of Chelmsford, Stephen Cottrell, spoke in his capacity as lead bishop on CMEAC, the Committee for Minority Ethnic Anglican Concerns. He explains why the debate was so important.
The hard truth is that in the Church of England, we've gone backwards on this issue in the last 20 years. So we've now got less black and minority ethnic people in so-called senior positions in the church than used to be the case. And this is something that we ought to be very concerned about. Indeed, we ought to be shocked about. But I'm not sure that we've really noticed it. So the point of the presentation and debate yesterday was really to alert Synod to this issue, but also to recognise that the way we deal with it is at every level. The reason we perhaps don't have black and Asian bishops and archdeacons is because we don't have enough black and Asian area deans and incumbents of parishes, and we don't have enough church wardens, and so on and so on. So the way we change this is by trying to say, how does the church that I'm a part of at the local level, how does that reflect the community that I'm part of, and therefore, and if it doesn't, what can we do about it?
It's quite interesting that you said then that it was as if we hadn't realised that the figures are worse now than they were. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, well, I'm not really sure. I'm not just resisting. I don't believe the issue is racism. In a way, if it was, it would be rather easier to tackle. I don't think the Church of England... There is racism in the Church, let's be clear. We do find some people who hold racist attitudes, and when we find those, we need to encounter them very clearly. But I don't actually think that the problem is quite that. I think it's more what perhaps one might call complacency. One of the issues we want to tackle is something called unconscious bias, which isn't racism by another form. It's to recognise that all of us have certain outlooks and prejudices which shape us and our decision making. And some of those might be to do with race and ethnicity, though they might also be to do with gender or sexuality. And we need to uncover what those are within ourselves to try to ensure that when we make decisions as a church at every level, we're doing it with our eyes open. So I just wonder whether there's an unconscious bias in the Church of England which is preventing us from noticing that actually we are a predominantly white church in an very increasingly and joyfully multicultural society.
Unconscious bias, that's got to be one of the most difficult things to address then, because by definition, people don't realise it's going on.
You know, let's not beat ourselves up about it, but let's change that. Let's change our culture by recognising that there are some practical things we can do in our parishes and communities, and there's some practical training that many of us can get in the Chelmsford Diocese. All of us who are bishops and archdeacons, we're all going to go on a course for unconscious bias later this year. And I'm going to be, or have written to the other my other bishops in the Church of England, saying, look, this training's available. CMIAC can help you put it on. These are some of the small ways that will change the culture.
What about encouraging people from all backgrounds and ethnicity into the church? Is that something else, or is that too simplistic to try and get so our churches reflect what our communities look like?
Well, clearly that's where we have to. Clearly that's what we have to be about, but again, we need to recognise that one of the reasons perhaps some people don't want to engage with the Church of England is because they don't see any role models in the leadership of the church. So there are churches, I can think of churches, where in the congregation there's an incredible mix of backgrounds and ethnicities, but the leadership up the front is white. Now, why is that? Is it that there's no talent, an ability in the congregation? Well, I simply don't believe that. Or is there some blockage in the system whereby those of us who have the power and influence are not... The other kind of key phrase from this would be affirmative action, that we take affirmative action to nurture and encourage people to take on leadership roles. That will create a kind of good cycle of inclusion and representation, which will have a very big impact in the wider community in terms of our evangelism and service.
And you can see a video released by CMIAC on the front page of the Church of England's website. Go to the In the News section. Finally, for many people, it was their last synod as they stand down from their roles. I met two such people, John Kiddle, who's Director of Mission at St Albans, and Paula Gooder, who's Theologian in Residence at the Bible Society. I asked Paula what she remembered of her first day at synod.
I do distinctly remember my first day because it's absolutely terrifying. It's in London, and you walk in through the doors of Church House, and as you walk in, there are just hundreds and hundreds of people all teeming around, and they all appear to know what they're doing, and you come in having no idea. You're not even sure if you've come to the right place or not. But slowly, that kind of the clarification dawns. You work out what you're doing and where you're going, and then the more the clarification dawns, the more interesting it becomes, because you get to work out what's going on and what are the key issues, and you begin to understand kind of some of the stuff that's really happening and behind the scenes at Synod.
John, you've not done quite as long as Paula has, no. But what were your first impressions?
I think, first of all, it was you're coming into something that already existed in quite a clear way, with lots of views about how things should be done. And the induction day, I found quite strange in that it seemed to be saying, this is the way you've got to behave and this is the way you will get things done. As time's gone on, I've seen the sense of that, and I think also I've seen it change a little bit and become a bit more relaxed. And there seems to me a clearer sense of why we're doing these things. And just like we've just had legislation about faculties, which may seem very hard work, but I think more and more people are saying this is because we're trying to make the church fit for mission.
Did you have a clear idea of what you wanted to achieve when you started?
I think primarily I wanted to learn about how things work and what the role of legislation and synod and debates was in it. I hoped I'd have particular contributions to make in debates about mission and especially, I think, giving parishes a voice, so that where the issues of going forward in mission were there on the ground, that there was somebody who could speak up and try and make sure that what was going on in Synod reflected that.
I joined Synod because I wanted to make a difference. I love the Church of England and I wanted it to be the best church that it could be. So part of my motivation for standing was so that I could make a real difference. But I was particularly interested in the ordination of women to the episcopate, and that was one of my great passions. And actually, over the space of the last 10 years, I've worked very hard with lots of other people on that legislation. So for me, there was a particular issue that I was interested in. But interestingly, having stood on one particular issue, I became aware that actually I'm really interested in a whole range of issues that Synod covers. And I think just one issue will not sustain your interest through Synod. You need to have a wide range of things that you care about the church to help you keep going through Synod.
Did you find that you became interested in things perhaps you wouldn't have considered before?
Yes, and I think seeing how all those different issues fit together, and I think sometimes just moving from one thing to another, like we're doing today. So on Monday we're going to be talking about the environment, which seems to be vitally important, because suddenly that's gone off the political and public agenda, and we're trying to say not just this should be back on the agenda and here's some ways of thinking about it that are theological and important, but also what we as a church are doing to put our own house in order.
What will you miss about Synod?
I think the people. What I will take back especially are the relationships I've made, and some, I mean, Paula was talking about women bishops, and I remember in our little group, actually the power of the group when people were suddenly discovering that they were actually being listened to, and I think those conversations then had quite a big effect in the way the final debate went and the vote went.
Again, the same, the people. There's something about the kind of person who stands for Synod, who are, many of them are interesting and fascinating, and you make real friendships here. And I'll miss the friends that I've made while I've been here.
And if you'd like to find out more about standing for the next term of Synod, go to the front page of our website and have a look at the Synod box, where you'll find a link to a video explaining the process. That's it for this week's podcast. I'm Gillian Moody. Thanks for listening.